Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Changing the breastfeeding culture to give mothers and babies a fundamental human right. The Katrina legacy and the slow rebirth of New Orleans. And Father Brand reflects on the fact that there must be no purpose in friendship save the deepening of the spirit. I got the idea for this program when I saw an article on an unusual event that took place in the Philippines a short while ago. The article reported an initiative organized by an advocacy group in which nearly 4,000 mothers set a new world record for the largest number of women simultaneously breastfeeding their babies in the same place. It sounded like fun and a lot of bonding, but in fact, I went on to read, the event was held to raise awareness about the benefits of breastfeeding in a country in which the breastfeeding rate has declined alarmingly, with only 1.4% of babies of 6 to 7 months old still being exclusively breastfed. Now, in my family, breastfeeding has always been seen as the most natural thing in the world, and I also happen to know that the percentage of mothers who can't physiologically breastfeed is very tiny. So what's going wrong? I decided to ask an expert. Now, when one thinks about breastfeeding, it's the most natural thing in the world, isn't it? It comes as a surprise to have to learn and to discover that breastfeeding is in need of support and encouragement.
This is absolutely true. I think it's recognized both in informal culture and certainly in all parts of the world that breastfeeding faces tremendous challenges.
David Parker is Deputy Director and Head of Research at the Innocenti Center.
I should say as well that just last November, there was an occasion to review progress and identify some of these challenges, and a celebration called Innocenti Plus 15 was held exactly to try to understand why progress remains still so limited in many cases. What I can say by way of background may be that when we speak of breastfeeding, what the experts and what one learns from culture, what it all comes to is that exclusive breastfeeding for 6 months and then partial breastfeeding with complementary feeding to 2 years is overall the type of standard that is optimal for infants.
So when I said that in my family breastfeeding was considered the most natural thing in the world, I apparently touched on one of the roots of the issue. Diana Senton, a leader for the Lecce League in Italy, certainly thinks so.
Unfortunately, at least in our Western culture, it's not so common to see women breastfeeding as it is in perhaps other cultures. We haven't grown up watching our mothers breastfeed our siblings or our aunts breastfeeding, and our grandmothers would have talked about their experiences as well, and all this information gets passed on generation to generation, and we grow up seeing it and accepting it as what's normal, and we learn that way, and unfortunately we happen to have that experience, most of us, and so there is a need for more information and more support.
But first things first, what is the Innocenti Center where David works, and what is La Lecce League?
In our work, we address a range of areas related to social and economic policies in children, nutrition, international standards for children in support of UNICEF and its work worldwide.
And La Lecce League is an organization which provides information and support to women who want to breastfeed their babies.
David, surfing your website, I came across something I didn't know existed, and that's the Innocenti Declaration. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
The Innocenti in Florence had the privilege to be the site of a historic meeting in 1990, attempted to set out for the first time a concerted international support of breastfeeding globally, building on work that had been done before, but it brought together WHO, UNICEF, a wide range of governments, non-governmental agencies supported, and it culminated in a Innocenti Declaration on the Protection, Promotion, and Support of Breastfeeding, which was really a milestone in the global movement in developing as well as developed countries.
Yes, because as Deanna explains, giving your baby breast milk is giving him the best start in life.
Human milk is perfectly designed for human babies, and it provides antibodies, protection against infections. It passes on the mother's immunities to various diseases that she may have had, and passes that immunity on to the baby. It's more easily digestible than cow's milk or formula milk. It reduces risks of allergies. It's been shown that children who are breastfed are less likely to be overweight or obese as they get older. There's a long list of actual documented physical benefits.
Yes, and also for the mother, I think.
For the mother as well, there have been studies to show that it reduces the risk of breast cancer. After the birth, it can reduce the risk of hemorrhaging. When the baby is nursing, that stimulates the uterus to contract.
And as David points out, breastfeeding, in fact, does more than just give a child the best start in life.
When you speak of the challenge that's faced now, what we also know is that from a medical point of view, it's found that breastfeeding could save an additional at least 1.2 million infant lives every year from improved breastfeeding alone, and possibly up to 2 million lives a year if it also includes this process of better complementary feeding in that period to 2 or 3 years. So it is absolutely more than any other preventive intervention essential to saving infants and children's lives.
However, even although personally committed to the challenges we face, David highlighted the fact that around the world, breastfeeding is still generally the norm for feeding infants.
But I think if we look at our modern global culture, if we look around the world, there are so many different issues. A lot has to do with mothers' time and the need to schedule in order to breastfeed regularly. There are many other barriers, some at the family level, some within the health system, and many related to the workplace. What we see is, in fact, it's not a single problem, but it's a combination of culture, of policies, of workplace, and the whole role of mothers in modern times. But it's something that so many groups and individuals have seen as critical, that it was precisely on this basis that so much action is being mobilized to try to support breastfeeding.
That's true, you know. The more I research the subject, the more I realise that there are literally hundreds of support groups and organisations that promote breastfeeding. But in Britain, for example, despite campaigns like the annual Breastfeeding Awareness Week, breastfeeding rates there are among the lowest, not only in Europe, but throughout the world.
Now, in a place like the Philippines, which is a poor country, do you think that the interests of infant formula producers have anything to do with the lack of breastfeeding?
Certainly the industry is a very big part of the whole culture and practice of breastfeeding and of lack of breastfeeding. We know that the sale of baby milk is about a $10 or $11 billion business annually. And we also know that formula and alternatives to breast milk are important in some cases where mothers have limited milk, where there are health concerns, where there are other practical reasons where they cannot breastfeed. But infant formula is a profitable product, and with any product, companies do try to find ways to promote its use. And this is, in fact, leading a long dialogue related to the International Code on Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes. But certainly around the world, and you'll have seen in your own travels as well, alternatives to breast milk, infant formula, are seen not only in practical terms, but very much a product and part of a commercial culture. And it's very, very important that mothers have the right kind of information, background, and awareness of how formula should be used, but the primary importance of breastfeeding.
It's true. Look around you, and everywhere you see images of babies being bottle-fed. On television, in books, in films, where there's a baby, there's usually a bottle. In shopping centres, you even find that the symbol for a breastfeeding room is a bottle.
However, Deanna, a woman who is always there for breastfeeding moms who need information and support, immediately straightened out my enthusiastic views when I asked her what success rate she has.
I don't consider it really success or failure, exactly. I guess success is when the mother is happy with her decision and breastfeeds successfully, if that's what that is her wish. Certainly the women who call me are wanting to be successful at breastfeeding, and usually it's something that any mother can achieve if given the right information.
Now, what David does, and his whole focus, of course, is very different to that of Deanna. But deep down, they both believe in the same thing.
The Innocenti Center, with its focus on research and linking to global advocacy, really tries to promote, in many ways, the idea, the concept, and the core principle that breastfeeding is a fundamental human right of mothers, and try to understand how legally, institutionally, and in policies and practice, how this right can be expressed so that mothers do enjoy the ability to breastfeed.
A fundamental human right of mothers. I had never thought of it in these terms, but I think that's a very beautiful way of putting it.
What we know is that breastfeeding is as much a cultural issue related to women's perceptions of their bodies, the public perception of what's appropriate for women. At some level, many women we know are reluctant to breastfeed for issues of their own self-perception. But we also know that, especially for poor women, and this is not only in the Philippines, but Italy and anywhere, that there are many practical constraints on mothers' ability to breastfeed. And these have to do with their workplace situation, the pressures of their home. One knows simply how much time, I mean, as a parent, and scheduling is involved in order to breastfeed, and particularly to breastfeed exclusively for 6 months. And it's in this regard that public information, but especially work of the health system, of community groups, of non-governmental groups, to be able to help women, to empower women, to have the opportunity in public spaces such as railway stations and other parts of cities. One wants to see ways to make it convenient for mothers to breastfeed. At another level, I think quite interesting to recognize the achievements of the International Code on Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, which, while it's now nearly 25 years since it's been established in the World Health Assembly, there's now a tremendous amount of progress in governing the role of hospitals in particular, and the development of what are called baby-friendly hospitals that promote breastfeeding, that limit the distribution and promotion of baby formula, and that provide information to mothers about how to breastfeed after they leave hospitals. The key role of working with the nurses, with health workers, with administrators, and in that way also linking with the industry in order that the culture can change. I think this is the fundamental point we would make, that what is key is the breastfeeding culture, in addition to individual practice, needs to change in the Philippines, as you've mentioned, and certainly in Europe and throughout the developing world.
And that really brings me back to where I started. Initiatives to promote breastfeeding are not about the woman's ability at all, but really they're all about culture. Because a survey shows most mothers who give up breastfeeding do so reluctantly. And although I can't vouch for it, I'm sure that goes for the babies as well. What's the future for the city of New Orleans as its citizens prepare to choose who will be their mayor in a key runoff ballot this weekend? It's been nearly 9 months since New Orleans was devastated by Hurricane Katrina, in the US's worst natural disaster, and more than half of its population is still scattered throughout the country. But how are the city's inhabitants coping with the daunting task of clearing away the debris and trying to rebuild their shattered lives and homes? And as the start of the 2006 hurricane season looms, how secure are New Orleans' flood barriers or levees, whose failure to contain the storm surge played a major role in the disaster last August? To find out more, Susie Hodges spoke to Archbishop Alfred Hughes, the Catholic Archbishop of New Orleans.
Yes, we're still struggling. About 20% of the city, of course, was not flooded, but 80% was. And where I am is part of that 80%. And I would say only about 20% of the stores, small businesses in my area have been able to reopen. And many people are living in FEMA trailers, waiting to be able to move back into their own home.
And how satisfied are people in New Orleans with the rebuilding effort so far?
I think in general, there is a considerable dissatisfaction. You know, it's been difficult for many, including myself, working with the Archdiocese, to get insurance settlements and to get assurance about where is going to be safe to rebuild, given the questions about the flood control for the future. And we still are uncertain as to what kind of federal assistance we're going to have in this work of rebuilding.
The 2006 hurricane season is nearly upon you. Are people in the city nervous and worried about a repeat disaster this summer? As I gather, the levees are still barely at the pre-Katrina levels.
Yes, if you talk with the ordinary citizen, you're going to find that there's considerable concern because of all the coastal erosion that's going to put more pressure on our levees, and the levees are not yet even to the pre-Katrina level. So there's a lot of anxiety about this next season. And, you know, because so many people are living in trailers, they're more vulnerable than they were even before.
And when it comes to the population in general, are people still very visibly traumatized by the Katrina disaster? Have you got any experiences there of your contacts with people that you could share with us?
Well, you know, when I celebrate Mass at the cathedral or in different parish churches, I inevitably meet people who are very depressed. The loss that they've sustained, the slowness of response. On the other hand, I would say those people who have been able to grapple positively, take what steps have been available to them, and face the adversity with a sense of hope have done very well.
I gather, though, that less than half of the city's former inhabitants have returned since Katrina. Do you believe that the city's population will ever return to its pre-Katrina levels?
That's certainly debatable. I see us struggling for the next 2 years. The best estimates are that we have just under 40% back now. I think after 2 years, a momentum will be in place, but it will then take 10 years before we have a new New Orleans.
Do you think the lessons, though, of Katrina have been learned, particularly, as you say, when it comes to things like flood control, the state of the levees?
I think the lessons have been learned intellectually. I don't think there's yet been mobilized the national resolve to do all that's necessary in order to address it.
Why is that, you think?
Well, the cost is so great, number one. And number two, this is a fast-moving time in which we live and people's attention is short-lived. And we move from preoccupation with one issue to another. And farther we get away from the moment when Hurricane Katrina hit us, the shorter is the span of interest and concern among people.
The mayor of New Orleans, Ray Nagin, is facing challenger Mitch Landrieu in a run-up election this weekend. How crucial do you think the result of this vote could be for the city's future?
Well, I'm not going to enter into the personalities involved, but the issues that they face, such as flood control, housing decisions, how larger footprint? Are we going to revitalize in a first stage of rebuilding public schools, public health? The decisions in those areas are daunting. It's going to be incredibly important that we have a mayor who is not overwhelmed by that, who is able to work constructively with the people on the federal level, the state level, and citizens on the local level to address these.
And how do you, and indeed the other people in the city, feel about New Orleans' future?
I'm a man of hope. I am convinced that for those who love the Lord, as St. Paul says, everything works unto good. I think tragedy matures people if we come together receptive to God's grace and work for the common good.
And do you think the other people, other inhabitants of New Orleans, share your optimism on the whole? Do you think people are quite upbeat or determined to rise from the ashes, as it were?
I wouldn't use the word upbeat. I think a majority of the people who are here right now are determined, and I think there's cautious hope. I think part of the role of leadership, however, is to contribute to a vision, be an encourager of others.
And now for a total change in mood. Father Jim Brand, spiritual director of the Pontifical Beda College here in Rome, continues in his musings on prayer and friendship, reflecting on The Prophet by Khalil Gibran.
I'm thinking about these words halfway through the poem on friendship by Khalil Gibran from The Prophet. Let there be no purpose in friendship save the deepening of the spirit. For love that seeks aught but the disclosure of its own mystery isn't love, but a net cast forth, and only the unprofitable is caught. Anyone who loves knows that there is something real there that can't be measured by test tubes or thermometers or the physics laboratories. What goes on between us is the spirit. Whether it's a holy spirit or a problematical spirit, it's by its fruits that you know it. So when people can say you and me, we're learning the language of the Trinity. The language of the Father and the Son is you and me. And the Holy Spirit is the and. But we can be very busy about our friendships and very manipulative. You might say, give her three gins and tonics and she's anybody's. Or they used to say in the army, they put extra some chemicals in the tea, which makes sure that you are nobody's. Didn't seem to have an effect on me. But sometimes we can be quite manipulative and very busy about friendships. We like instant friendship because we live in a world where everything's instant. Instant mashed potato, instant whip, instant everything. And some people want instant friendship. Well, the most important things in the world take time. It takes centuries for a diamond to form under high temperature and pressure. And when you find diamonds, it's simply surrounded by an awful lot of rubbish and other stuff. And even then, the diamond doesn't look very spectacular. It has to be cut. Oh, how painful. It has to be polished in order to refract light. That takes time, centuries to make diamonds. I think it takes 2 years to give birth to an elephant. Why is it we always want instant love, instant friendship? So it requires the Holy Spirit's gift of patience. For Gibran says that love that seeks aught but the disclosure of its own mystery isn't love but a net cast forth. and only the unprofitable is caught. We have to remember that we're lent to each other. We belong to God. And if we try to possess people or catch them or trap them, the Lord says, let my people go. Because real friendship dies when there's any manipulation or lack of patience, or people get pushed into friendship, sometimes from a sense of guilt because we're so generous to them. And we'll never know really whether people loved us or whether they loved what we do for them. And then he goes on to say, let your best be for your friend. Oh dear. So often my friends haven't had the best of me. They've had scraps of time. I remember when I was first ordained, I was chaplain to the Middlesex Hospital. I used to work so hard there and in the parish. And occasionally I'd go home to my parents on a Sunday evening. I was so tired, I wasn't any fun at all. And then once it happened to me, a priest friend was coming for some supper with me. And I'm quite a good cook, and I had a little electric ring with three saucepans who took their turn on the ring. I made some homemade wine, some of my homemade candles, a really nice supper ready for my friend. And I looked out of the window. There he was, slid down the banisters, out of the front door, went all the way to meet him, brought him in. He plonked himself down and said, I'm so tired, I don't think I could eat anything. He went to sleep on the couch. Well, I was glad he had a rest. But so often, we don't give our best for our friends. My motto now is, prime time for friends. I think it's the most important thing in the world. And when we preach about love, people know whether we know what we're talking about. My face lights up. I'm animated. I'm inspired. People say this man speaks with authority, not just what he's read in books. I'm convinced that if we put friendship as the most important thing in the world before anything else, this will give inspiration to everything else we do. And what about the divine friend? I know what it is to say, oh, I've got 10 minutes to spare. Lunch is in 10 minutes. It's not worth writing a letter, not worth reading any more of my book, I'll pray. Sometimes the Lord, who calls us his friend, gets scrag ends of time, bits that aren't useful for anything else. Prime time for the divine friend. Prime time for our friends. So let's make some dates. Let's put a line through our diaries sometimes to give prime time for friends. Then we'll have some wonderful staging post to look forward to. And afterwards, what a happy evening together. What a happy memory. Let your best be for your friend. For if he must know the ebb of your tide, let him know its flood also. Sometimes we only hear from our friends when they're in trouble. What a shame. More of that next week.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.